Hey, what's going on? It's At the Letters, Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson Smith. Our producers are Christian Ryan and Mike Tassoni, and this is the special holiday edition of At the Letters. Ben and I are going to answer your questions and give you something to listen to here on the week of the holidays. Hope that you are having a happy and a safe holidays wherever you may be and winding down this terrible, terrible year. So let's get to it. You have sent us your questions on Twitter. We're going to answer them right now. First question comes from Link at Link1005. Hi, Arden and Ben. What are your thoughts on Alejandro Kirk? Do you feel comfortable enough with Kirk behind the plate? And is his bat legit enough to be the primary catcher for this club moving forward? Looking forward to the next pod. Ben, I'm looking forward to your answer to this question.
For sure. And I'll start by saying thanks to everyone who sent in questions. We're going to get to a lot of them, a few or a couple dozen questions at least here. If we don't get to yours, we still read it. We still appreciate it. With that said, yeah, we'll start with Link here. I think Alejandro Kirk is in a good position for this team. I think his bat is super intriguing. I don't think that he's someone that you pencil in as a starter. I do think that there are still questions around what he brings defensively, but you love the bat, you love the contact ability, and it's just intriguing to see a player with his body type and with his kind of pedigree and history coming up through the minor leagues succeeding at such a young age. And it's going to be fun to see what he can do in 21.
Let me put it to you this way. If nothing else changes and the Blue Jays go forward with the catchers who are currently on their 40-man roster, is Alejandro Kirk on the opening day 26-man roster?
I think I find it easier to imagine a scenario where the Blue Jays bring in a veteran. And this could be, you know, I'm not saying Caleb Joseph, but in the mold of a Caleb Joseph, someone who likely signs a minor league deal with this team, is a caddy of sorts, someone who brings experience to the pitching staff. And then Kirk, in that situation, would start double A, triple A. You know, the whole minor leagues are kind of in flux right now. So a lot of variables right there. But that's how I see it. Is that how you see things unfolding at this point?
That's absolutely what I was setting up there. Is that if, yeah, opening day was tomorrow, I think Alejandro Kirk is probably starting at double or triple A and catching every day. It's just about the opportunity, right? He's just not going to have as much opportunity in the majors. Danny Jansen, obviously, you know, cemented there as your starting catchers, things stand today. So I just think that it would make the most sense that Kirk, you know, I think people are kind of assuming that Kirk is just going to be on the big league roster to start the 2021 season. And I don't think it's necessarily a safe assumption at all, which is to take nothing away from, you know, everything that he accomplished in 2020 and how good he was in the, you know, what it might have been like 25 plate appearances that he got right at the end of the year. You know, it was not exactly the biggest sample, but yeah, I think that that's the most likely scenario, is that Kirk starts in the minors just so that he can get some games under his belt, some innings under his belt, and be catching consistently.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's someone who will appear for the Blue Jays in 21, just doesn't have to be on that opening day roster. So with that, we move on to our second question. This one comes from Billy B at Bill Bradley 44. Hi, Bill. Happy holidays. Same to you. I'd be interested to know where you think the Jays' top 10 prospects are going to be assigned to start 2021. What do you think, Arden?
So I'm not going to go through all 10 right prospects.
That would be a whole podcast in itself.
But I will say that I think you're going to see some pretty aggressive placements in 2021. And I think it's something that every organization is going through right now, is trying to determine where to put guys after not having a minor league season in 2020 and working off of alt site data. And in a lot of cases, players who didn't even make it to the alt site. So players who are just working out at home and maybe have been coming through the complex during the off season. But for the Blue Jays specifically, when it comes to players in that top 10, like Austin Martin or like a Jordan Groshans, like, I don't think it's out of the question that those guys start at AAA, or one of them's a double A and the other one's at AAA. Like, I think there's a very real pathway to the big leagues this year for both those guys, Austin Martin especially. Like, I think there's a very real opportunity that if those guys hit the ground running at the double A, triple A, and show everything that they need to show, that they could be major leaguers by the end of the 2021 season. So I think you're going to see some pretty aggressive placements for the Blue Jays, because I think that they learned a lot of things in 2020 about challenging young players with aggressive assignments. You think about, we just talked about Alejandro Kirk, right? Like, talk about a guy who went to the alt site having not played above A ball in his life and earned himself a spot on a major league club. A lot of that had to do with the opportunity that was there in the big leagues and Blue Jays needing a catcher and needing some more offense from that position. So that would have to happen for a Martin or a Groshans. There would have to be an opening and there would have to be a need at the major league level. But I think those guys will have a pretty easy job proving that they're worthy of that opportunity.
Yeah, I think upper minors for guys like Groshans and Martin, certainly in play. You think about where Austin Martin would have begun a traditional season last year, would have likely gone to Vancouver for a stint at low A, short season. And then that would set him up potentially to start, you know, a traditional placement would probably be high A Dunedin with a quick path to New Hampshire and then see what happens there. So going forward, I could see double A being a starting point for Austin Martin and Jordan Groshans. I mean, I don't see triple A as a starting point, depending on how things unfold, but I would see them having a pretty quick path to that. You know, within a month or two, if things are going well, you could imagine that they would be called on. And I do think the big leagues are in play for those guys.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that just in general, going forward, you're going to see a lot more sort of rapid ascents through the minors with like a smaller minor league system with clubs depending more on their complexes in Florida or in Arizona to sort of transition players out of either high school amateur ball or college amateur ball. Like you think about a guy like Austin Martin, like he spent his last 3 years in what is essentially a pro style environment at Vanderbilt University. Like look up Vanderbilt's facilities and how much money they've put into that and like what their athletes are experiencing on a day-to-day basis. Like it rivals the, you know, complexes of some big league clubs. It was probably better than the Blue Jays facilities were until they renovated, right? Like what the Blue Jays facilities were, you know, 3 years ago, I think Vanderbilt probably had better facilities that Austin Martin was working at. And now he gets to work at this massively renovated player development complex, which is going to be like a huge boon for this organization going forward. But I do think that, like, you know, for all those reasons, you're going to see players get into the big leagues a lot faster going forward, just because teams are going to be better at transitioning them and developing them.
Yeah, exactly. You're not picking them off the backfields. You know, they're definitely, in the case of a guy like Martin, got a lot more high level competition. I think Groshans maybe a little bit ahead of Martin on the depth chart, but a couple prospects to watch.
Yeah, Groshans interesting because he just hasn't played. And so, you know, he didn't just miss 2020, it was 2019 with the foot thing, right? So he's just got to get in games and kind of prove that he's healthy and just like, should, you know, be a baseball player again, something he hasn't done in a while. But like if the Blue Jays are using kind of objective measurables in order to place guys, I promise you that Groshans going to be off the charts, you know, and Austin Martin off the charts. Like Gabby Moreno, a guy who was like MVP of the alt site and is like tearing it up in the Venezuelan league right now. Like another guy off the charts who is going to have a pretty aggressive placement, I think. This question is sort of related to what we're talking about. It's from at the Corey Haslam. If the Jays don't land an impact outfielder, Ben, could we see Austin Martin moved full-time to center field?
Really interesting. Really interesting. And this ties into what we're talking about before. I think that from an organizational standpoint, the need is greatest in center field. I do believe that. And the best case scenario for Austin Martin's development might well be playing him in center field. I think that's something the Blue Jays will look to do. And based on comments that Ross Atkins has made, based on comments that Scott Boras has made, you know, there's an openness to playing different positions there. Now, at the same time, I've heard from people who suggest that from a throwing standpoint, Austin Martin hasn't always looked super comfortable throwing. So that's something that, you know, these things can change pretty quickly. They can change depending on positions too. Think about Lourdes Gurriel Jr., who's much more comfortable throwing from the outfield than he ever was throwing from the infield. So a lot of that is context dependent, and those things can change as a player develops. But that's something that I would watch. I think that if Martin shows, and you know, by all accounts, he has the speed, the athleticism, I think that's the best case scenario is if he can play center field.
Yeah, I think the throwing thing was more of an accuracy problem than a strength problem is kind of my understanding of it, particularly from third base. So, you know, how would that translate to the outfield, right? It's kind of the question. Like if he's got the arm strength from the outfield, like can he, you know, easily make those throws to home plate. Like we saw, like Gurriel did something similar, right? Like had an accuracy problem from second base, throwing the ball, moved to left field. Now he's gunning everybody out. So
yeah,
it's like, it's funny how these things translate sometimes. And so if there is like a throwing issue at third, it might not be an issue in center. We'll see. I think like best case scenario with Austin Martin is that he, like, in a 7-day work week, like, you know, 2 days in center, 2 days at third, a day in left and a DH day or something, right? Like, I think that's best case scenario, and we'll see if that's what happens. Ultimately, it's going to come down to what needs the Blue Jays have at the time that Austin Martin's ready to be a big leaguer and where they have room for him. You know, like, if DJ LeMahieu is playing third base, probably playing, you know, Austin Martin might not be playing third base, right? Like, you know, George Springer's playing center field. Don't know if Austin Martin's going to be playing center field. But, like, even just in general, we talk way too much about, we worry way too much about positions with prospects. It doesn't matter. Like, the just hit, that's all that matters, really. But also, they'll find a place for him if he's a really good, strong, athletic player who's going to help this team. Like, they'll find a place for him to play. It doesn't, it's not worth, like, even really considering right now, even in the greater context of, like, what is a position in baseball anymore? You got shifts against left-handed hitters where you got third baseman making plays in the right field corner, you know?
Manny Machado. So, like,
it's, you know, what, like, well, what even is a position anymore? The MLB is becoming so much more positionless as we go forward. It's kind of like basketball in that way, and other sports where kind of the lines are blurring. So this will all sort itself out, I promise.
Right. I don't think the Dodgers are worried too much about, you know, is Max Muncy really a first baseman or is he a second baseman? Is Cody Bellinger our center fielder of the future, or is he just a guy who can play an amazing first base and who can also play center field? And of course, he could play left or right if he wanted to. He would probably pitch too. I mean, those are good problems to have, and it comes down to the bat, like you said. So as long as Austin Martin hits, they'll figure just it out. And if he can field well, that's a bonus, and the Jays will do everything they can to make that happen.
Just hit.
That's right. All right. So another question for you, Arden, and this one comes from Aiden Hauker at Breakfast 905. Out of the biggest name free agents the Jays have been interested in, so LeMahieu, Springer, Realmuto, Bauer, etc., which player do you expect to fall off the most in the latter years of a realistic contract?
LeMahieu's the oldest of that group, I want to say, right? He's 32 and Springer's 31.
Bauer's around 31, 32.
Realmuto's like 29, 30.
Yeah, Realmuto, so, I think, is the youngest of those.
Yeah, so LeMahieu being the oldest, I mean, that's kind of the easiest answer there. Yeah, if you're, you know, in year five of a, you know, 5-year deal with a 32-year-old and he's 37, is probably not going to look so great at the end of it. But that's like the case with any, you know, 5-6 year contract the Blue Jays are going to sign with a top of the market free agent. Is like, you're going to be buying some decline. Like, you're paying for some decline years, right? Like, it's, you know, it's the same thing with the Russell Martin deal, right? Like, first couple of years looked great, fantastic. Got him, you know, when he was still sort of like in the latter part stages of his prime and productive and playing every day and awesome. And then by the end of that contract, it was kind of like, oh geez, what are we going to do about this situation? That's always the case with when you're dealing with long-term free agent contracts. So whether it's George Springer running around on turf, you know, as an outfielder who relies on his legs, whether it's, you know, LeMahieu being 32, whether it's Haik and Trevor Bauer, like, sustain the workload that he, you know, has talked about wanting to pitch every 4 days and the amount of innings that he's had on him, whether it's JT Realmuto behind the plate getting beat up with foul tips and, you know, blocking balls with his crotch and, you know, diving around and getting banged up and being, you know, just all the wear and tear the catchers take on. I mean, all these guys probably are going to, you know, have some decline towards the end of their contracts.
Right. The safe bet is all of the above, of course. So so are you going LeMahieu? Is that your kind of answer?
Yeah, I guess so. Because he's the oldest right now. So if you sign him for 5 years, like, he's 37 by the end of that.
And it might take a 5-year deal to land him in Toronto. You know, and it was interesting because Bo Bichette made the comments last week as we record this on Ross Stripling's podcast, where he was saying he thinks that LeMahieu is the best hitter in baseball. And when I tweeted that out, I got some people kind of pushing back saying, no, he's not. Like, this is ridiculous. And I don't think he's the best hitter in baseball. I think Mike Trout is, maybe Mookie Betts is second. Like, it's not DJ LeMahieu, but DJ LeMahieu did lead the American League in batting average, on base percentage, WRC plus, OPS plus. Like, he kind of was the best hitter in the American League, at least. So it's not that far fetched.
So it's like, what do you value as a hitter, right? Like, is a hitter a guy with a high batting average who literally just a guy who gets a lot of hits? Or is a hitter a guy who's going to put up like a huge OPS because he walks a bunch, and then when he does put the ball in play, like, it goes off the wall or over it?
Right. And I mean, in LeMahieu's case, you're getting both. At least the last couple of years, you've been getting both. Now, he probably doesn't project that way going forward. He probably projects more as like a 290 hitter with some really good power, or with some decent power. He's not a 40 home run bat. We all know that. But I think that, to me, I would have a bit more confidence in LeMahieu as someone who's going to age somewhat well. Defensively, who knows? But I think he'll be able to hit and put the bat on the ball and make good contact. To me, I would have the biggest concerns with Bauer out of that group. You know, if you're talking about a six-year deal, maybe six, seven-year deal, that's oftentimes what it takes to sign the top pitcher available. You'd think it's at least five. So somewhere in that range, man, you know, that's a long time. You have a lot of years for things to go in different directions there as a pitcher. So that would be my answer.
I will say, and this is just going off board here, but like low key, I think Freddie Freeman's the best hitter in baseball.
Sure.
You want to talk about like who's the best hitter in baseball? Like,
yeah.
I can't think of a more underrated guy who just does not get mentioned in the like conversations, right? Like his name doesn't come up. And he's just kind of an unassuming, quiet guy, like going about his business in Atlanta. Year after year after year, that dude produces so
good. Juan Soto, Acuna. I mean, there are a lot of candidates for that title. I don't think it's crazy to have LeMahieu in that group.
No, it's absolutely not. Give me Freddie Freeman as the best hitter in baseball. At Mike Mac 2112. What features would you like to see, Ben, at the new Jays ballpark? This is from Mike in Guelph.
Well, I think longtime ATL listeners would know that you know, we've made the case before for having more statues, having a better celebration of the franchise's history. Blue Jays right now are coming up on 50 years of existence. That's just a long time. That's a lot of baseball, and there's a lot of great players and moments worth celebrating. So I think that's the baseline starting point. And you know, in years past, obviously not 2020, but you and I have had the chance to go to a lot of different ballparks, and you just see at different parks, teams do a way better job than the Blue Jays at this. The Blue Jays are like, they're one of the worst teams that I've witnessed at celebrating their history. You know, the Trop probably would be another space where there's not really a lot of great celebration of the Rays history, but also the Rays are way younger than the Blue Jays. There's less history there to celebrate. So I think that would be the number one for me. I think obviously you're looking at retractable roof, you're looking at natural grass. If you can do that, you want to better integrate the city and the stadium. So all those things come into play, and those are some big asks. But if you're going to the point of making a new stadium, you should be thinking big, and you should be ambitious in what you're trying to achieve.
Roof is number one. Like, need a retractable roof.
Right.
Playing baseball in Toronto, Ontario, Canada in April, you need a roof. And you hope also playing baseball here late in October as well. So you need a roof. And then that connects to how you open up the ballpark to the city, as you mentioned, because you want to like feel the city when you're in the ballpark. You want to be kind of open to whether you're incorporating the skyline like at PNC Park with the, you know, the beautiful skyline there in Pittsburgh, or whether it's like you're incorporating the waterfront. If the Blue Jays are moving towards the Portlands, right? And if they're going more, you know, towards the water, if you can incorporate some of that, although it's like, you know, it's not the most picturesque, well, you know, it's not exactly McCovey's Cove, but, you know, if you can, something like that. So, you know, figure out how you get the retractable roof in there, and then what kind of like glass panels you're going to have on the side, or, you know, what sort of like, you know, Houston, like Minute Maid Park scenario you're going to have where it retracts and you're actually feeling some of the city. So that's like the really big one for me. I don't care about natural grass. People are so crazy about the playing surface. People are so crazy about grass. I don't think that it was ever realistic that there was going to be grass at Rogers Center. I really don't, like, I don't care what they were studying at Guelph. Like, I just don't think it was ever going to happen. You're growing a massive amount of grass indoors in this like dungeness ballpark.
Not at Rogers Center.
No, right?
No. So, now, what about in a new park?
I don't care. Like, just what's feasible. What makes sense, right? Like, these, like, the synthetic playing surfaces are good. Like, they're fine. You're seeing a lot of, more teams are moving towards them now than away from them.
Yes.
There are like five ballparks now that have them. There was only two a few years ago. So if it's easier to maintain, and if it's going to give you a more consistent bounce, a more consistent playing surface, rather than like have sort of, you know, differences depending on where the ball lands, I don't care. Who cares? It doesn't impact my enjoyment of the game watching it, whether it's natural grass or artificial turf. I don't care. Like, so, you know, if I'm a player and I'm running around on it, I'm going to have some views on it. Sure. So let's listen to them. But like, as a spectator, why do I care?
It looks better.
It looks about the same. What are you, if you're at the ballpark, you're staring at the grass? No, you're watching the game. You're staring at the field.
It's part of the experience of being there. I think it adds something to me. And that's not to say that it does for everybody, but it's more like you're outside when there's grass. It's less like you're inside the Astrodome and it's just like this, you know, you're playing like arena baseball. You know, it's more like you're truly outside.
I just think people get way too crazy about the playing surface and about the grass. Who cares? It doesn't matter. And like beyond that, like better craft beer options is a huge one. Better local beer and food options.
Not that we get to enjoy them there.
No.
But see, this is us, you know, shouting at the ATL listeners and food. Totally right? Agree.
Just like local stuff from like around the area. Right? You got St. Lawrence Markets like right there. You know, like you got like there's so much culture.
Steam Whistle Brewery right there.
Yeah, and texture to this city that you can incorporate there instead of having just like the usual, you know, big name, like big brand type of stuff there. Give people some cool local stuff to eat and drink and some cool places to like consume it, because like, you know, modern ballparks now are kind of like about anything but the game. Like they're about like, give us something to do to distract us from this boring game being played. So like, give us a bar in left field, right? And give us a place we can walk around like the flight deck and whatever. Like you just got to give people things to do and places to congregate, to gather, like kind of those open spaces. But that's kind of like smaller stuff, you know, beyond the larger architectural concerns of like a roof and opening this thing up and playing surface.
And a press box that's not in the left field corner, please.
My press box right now is my kitchen table. So
yeah.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, true. Being at a ballpark would be an improvement.
True. We'll start with that. All right. Our next question comes from Chris, MC0874. Thanks for the question. Do you think, because of the shortened 2020 season, the teams may be inclined to go with six-man rotations to help with workloads? Thanks. What do you think?
Yeah, I could certainly see it. Like, I think it's going to be a case-by-case basis. It's going to depend on the pitchers that you're relying on. You know, like, if you've got, like, a Tanner Roark, like, I feel pretty confident sending him out there to throw 150, 60, 170 innings this year, right? Like, he's done it before. It's kind of been the hallmark of his career, his durability. Now, if you have a Nate Pearson, yeah, maybe I'm going to be a bit more cautious, right? You know, if you have a Hyunjin Ryu with a pretty decorated injury history, yeah, I'm going to be a bit more cautious. But like, I think that like even just generally, like as a sport, baseball is going to start moving more towards like kind of a dynamic and fluid situation with the pitching rotation and with how guys are used. And I think that the frequency of their use and their workload is going to be a lot more based on how they're recovering and how they're performing. And so that's going to include like a lot of measurables in between outings in terms of shoulder strength and stability and release point and spin rate and like taking a look at, you know, what they're, you know, how they're sleeping, right? How they're recovering. You know, I think that you're going to see pitchers someday, all of them going out wearing those little wearables on their back, like the catapult technology that's going to track their, you know, heart rate and track, you know, their workload and how much stress they're under. And you're going to use all of those indicators to tell you how much you can push this guy and when actually he would benefit from a bit more recovery. And then so instead of having just like traditional five-man rotation where it's like you go, okay, now you go, like you're, it's going to be a lot more fluid and a lot more flexible in terms of how guys are used.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, you know, when you think about that five-man rotation, you know, it's not even that long ago that used to be the case. Like, it's not just like when we were kids, but I was looking back, I don't know why, but I was looking back at the 2012 Angels recently. And if you look at that team on Baseball Reference, they had like five starting pitchers. CJ Wilson was one of them. Vernon Wells is on that team. I think that's why I was looking at it. But anyway, it's relatively recent that was the model. Now it's just not. I don't think that teams even attempt to plan out their pitching staffs 10 days in advance. Like they just don't. It's too far in advance. They plan the rotations. They have an idea, of course. Yeah, this year, you know, your next couple starts are going to be here and here. If you are, you know, an established starting pitcher, you have a pretty good sense of what that's going to look like. But in the case of other pitchers, it's really day by day. It's week by week. You're constantly optioning guys back and forth. There are health concerns. This year, there was COVID to take into account that might continue into 2021. So you're always just managing that bullpen factors in. The lines between the bullpen and the rotation are blurred more than ever. Yep. So you've just got all these variables that you're figuring out. And I suspect that when Pete Walker and Charlie Montoya are sitting down and they're trying to figure out what does our pitching staff look like, the end point of that is something like a week from that day. Like, I don't think they're trying to map out 3 weeks at a time. I really think it's, okay, what are we doing today? How does that impact tomorrow? And then we have a general sense, this is how we're going to use guys for the next few days after that.
Yeah, even blurring of lines between roles, as you mentioned, right? Like, what are, you know, what's going to be a starter going forward, right? What's going to be a reliever, you know? Like, I think that you're going to see a lot more creative, you know, what we've seen that everybody hates lately and the way pitching staffs have been used. And you're just going to see a lot more of it, man. And I just think that, you know, the days of having five workhorse starters who all throw 200 innings is probably well behind us.
Oh, yeah. Like, will there ever be another team that has five starters that go 200 innings?
Can't imagine it.
Yeah, right? I don't think so.
It's hard to imagine that happening, especially with, like, it's just how hard guys throw these days, right? And like how max effort everything is. You know, every pitcher is like trying to throw as hard as he can and as nasty as he can. And if that just gets them through like four innings, their team is ecstatic. Like they're really happy about that, right? Like, oh, cool. Like you gave up like two hits over four. Great. We can like piece together the rest of it. I don't care how many pitches it took you. And I don't care that you're gassed now in the fifth, because I've got other dudes coming out of my bullpen who throw just as hard with, you know, amazing spinning stuff as well. Like the days of like kind of the command and control crafty guys who, you know, don't throw particularly hard, but, and don't throw max effort on every pitch, but are going to, you know, get through six, seven innings. Just, you know, you're just not seeing that many of those guys in the game anymore, because those aren't the guys that get paid.
That's right. And we'll see a little tick back toward that with the, you know, the full season as opposed to a 60 game, where the value of a Tanner Roark will increase a little bit next year. But those changes are not going to stop. Those changes are already well on their way.
Back to prospects. This is from Tammy Rainey. Regarding potential fast rising players like Simeon Woods Richardson, Jordan Groshans, Austin Martin, would it not be logical from the team's perspective to not add a player to the 40 unnecessarily until after there's a new CBA in place and you know what the roster management implications will be?
Great question. Definitely forward thinking here, because, and teams have to at least have in the back of their minds the fact that there is a CBA negotiation coming up in less than a year. So we're all kind of bracing ourselves for that reality. Now, I think teams are definitely wary of managing, or they're aware of 40-man roster implications. So the moment that they add someone to the 40-man, that essentially starts the clock for the time that you have to option those guys up and down. And then boom, you only get three option years. So teams are mindful of that. Now, if a player is ready and there's a need at the major league level, like let's say in that situation that you outlined, Arden, Austin Martin has a great, great season. The Jays have a need. They're in contention. They're trying to win a division. They're trying to clinch a wild card spot. I mean, at that point, I think you just promote the guy and you figure out the 40-man later. But they would be aware of this and they would keep in the back of their minds, hey, we don't want to unnecessarily add anyone to the 40-man unless we have to.
Yeah, I think what's most logical is to roster the best players and try to win as many games as possible. You know, I can not be so ghoulish as to like, you know, say, oh yeah, the Blue Jays need to think about, you know, how 40-man rules might change, you know, under the next CBA. Like, just play under the current CBA and the current rules that you have. And if you have an opportunity in 2021 to go win a World Series, then go do that. You know, and to win a division, like, put the best players on the field and win. Because winning will take care of everything. That's the whole point of the game, is to win.
That's right.
That's how I feel about it.
That's fair. All right, let's move on to our next question from Keen DeCuna. With the Real Muto rumors and the emergence of Kirk, what is Danny Jansen's place on the team? Is he trade bait or the safety net catcher until Kirk is ready? What do you think?
I think he's, you know, we kind of talked about this earlier. If the regular season started tomorrow, I think he's starting game one. And I think he's, you know, catching 4 to 5 times a week, maybe 3 to 4 with a DH day. I think obviously you would have liked to see him transfer some of the offensive numbers a bit better from the minors to the majors at this point in his young career. But the walk rate was better last year, which is encouraging because that was a lot of what he did really well in the minor leagues. Like, he just got on base a lot because you know, he was walking a lot. So if he can walk a bit more, we know he's got the power. Like, you know that he can run into one. If he can barrel the ball a bit more consistently, swing it less crap. It's kind of the thing with every player at the majors, right? You get to the majors and it's like, do you swing at the crap or do you not, right? So you don't swing at the crap, then you're going to get pitches in the zone, and those are the ones that you can drive. If you got to the major leagues, you can probably drive pitches in the zone. So that's going to be it for him. But like, yeah, I think he's this team's starting catcher.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it was a challenging year. Offensively, Jansen didn't get the results he wanted. I think that you can look at that playoff game, two home runs. I mean, it's just one game, but it's also one of the most significant games the Jays played. Really tough pitching staff. He hit a couple bombs. So a nice way to go into the offseason. I agree. He is that number one catcher for this team, barring some big acquisition or change there.
Yeah, and he's improved his framing a lot over his time in the majors, which is like, framing is an interesting thing, right? Because like, is framing going to be a stat in 3 years? Or are we going to have robotic umpires, right? Like, if I'm developing young catchers, am I really like hammering them on receiving and receiving maybe, but like framing,
Probably for now.
Are we going to have robo-umps in 2-3 years? It's not going to matter.
Yeah, I mean, this would be a question for the Jays development people, but I would assume you still got to make sure your catchers can frame it for now.
Sure, but it's probably not the main priority of my development, right? Like, I'm probably working on, blocking pitches in the dirt and handling, game calling and things like that more so than I am
throwing,
framing, right?
Tough job, man.
Yeah. Thinking about where the game's going. Where are we here? Scott, how long of a leash does Vlad get at third? Assuming the Jays add a high-end piece or two, they are pretty well in win-now mode. They probably aren't going to want to cost themselves too many runs and dig themselves a hole.
So how long of a leash does Vladdy get? I mean,
is there a leash to begin with?
Yeah, exactly. I don't
think the question assumes that he's going to be playing third. It's a big assumption.
I don't think that there is a leash. I think that, Vladdy is trying to create that leash. He wants there to be a leash. He wants to play third. He's playing third in the Dominican right now. I'm sure probably a lot of people listening, to this podcast have seen some of the highlights of Vladdy. And they haven't been good defensively. He's off to a bit of a rocky start there. And that's okay. That's the place to do it. It's the time to do it. No one's expecting perfection when he goes down there and tries to reacclimate to that position. So he's trying to play his way back into that mix, basically. And that might happen or it might not happen. But he doesn't have guarantees of playing time there.
Yeah, we went over this last podcast, so I'm not going to, reiterate too much. But yeah, Vlad was not a good defender when he was even in better shape, two seasons ago. So it's, to me, like the defense thing with Vlad, I know it's a huge topic right now. But it's kind of like we were saying with Austin Martin, just hit. And nobody's going to talk about any of this stuff anymore. Like if Vlad's out there with like a 380 OBP and like a 450 slug, nobody's going to be talking about his defense.
You don't think so? I mean,
at like, that point, nobody's going to care. At that point, it's like, okay, just be Miguel Cabrera. That's fine.
Yeah.
Are we upset about that? Like,
no. Everyone would take that. If you could snap your fingers and do that, I think the Blue Jays would.
Yeah. Just hit to your potential, man. Just hit. That's it. Yeah. There, we only talk so much about his defense over the first two seasons of his big league careers because he hasn't quite hit to the potential that he obviously has.
Yeah.
He hasn't fulfilled that potential. But if he was, hitting like Juan Soto or Ronald Acuna or something, we probably would be like, yeah, just be a first baseman. That's cool. Like,
yeah,
you screw up a pop fly in foul territory every once in a while. That's okay. Like, because you're hitting 45 bombs.
It would be okay. It would be a different conversation for sure. It would be a different conversation. I mean, But even then, like Soto and Acuna are better defensive players than Vlad. No,
that's true.
Like he's not good. Tatis, like the young guys, he's been well below average defensively. So I think that just further underscores the point. He has a lot of work to do if he wants to be back in that mix. All right. We have a question here from Choice Bro, who listens to our podcast regularly from Australia, which is awesome. Thank you for listening. Do you think the uncertainty with the 2021 season and where the Jays are going to be based, Buffalo, Toronto, et cetera, is going to hamper signing a big free agent?
I think it's definitely a question that's coming up for them. As much as they may try to like downplay it, I think for sure, like it's going to be every free agent's asking about this and every, representation of that free agent is making their client very aware of the possible outcomes here, as they should be. That's their job. I think the Blue Jays being upfront about, look, we want to play in Toronto and here are what our alternatives would be if we don't. Buffalo was mentioned in the question. I hear a lot of Buffalo talked about like the Blue Jays are not going to play in Buffalo this year. I don't think. I really like very, very small percentage chance that the Blue Jays play in Buffalo. Like I really think that they're going to try to play in Toronto. We'll see if the government lets them or not. If they don't, I think most realistically they play in Dunedin. And whether that's just for the first couple months of the season until there's vaccine prevalency and they can come up to Toronto and play in Toronto, even in front of fans, who knows? Or if they're in Dunedin for the entire year. I think that would be the primary alternative. And then beyond that, it would be the players saying, we don't want to play in a minor league ballpark. We want to play in a major league ballpark, which a number of the players wanted to do this season. Blue Jays tried to make it work out and they couldn't. And then everybody settled for Buffalo. But the players came back and were like, no, this time get us a big league ballpark. Then I think you would see that sort of Baltimore scenario or the Pittsburgh scenario, PNC Park, play out where the Blue Jays share a park with one of those teams. But I don't think Buffalo is very high on the list of alternatives at all. But yeah, as it pertains to free agents, I think you at least know as a free agent, here's the short list of outcomes and of options of where I'm going to go. But that still doesn't make it any easier to kind of take that to your spouse and your kids or to your family, or, you know, that doesn't make it any easier when you're thinking about your what your tax situation is going to be, having that uncertainty.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Do you know if that, this is a side note, do you know if that would impact taxes? Like if they play out of... Yeah.
Where is your work? Like, where are you based?
Right. But they're an employee of the Toronto Blue Jays. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
My understanding of it, and I know the Blue Jays have like a whole tax presentation that they give to the players. My understanding of it is when you're a MLB player and you play, if you play games in Pittsburgh, you got to pay Pennsylvania state tax. If you play some games in Arlington, you got Texas or whatever, right? Like wherever you go and work, you have to pay taxes in each of those places. That's my understanding of it, but I am not well versed in this. So
last year, or I guess playing in the U.S. could actually have some tax benefits for the Blue Jays. Yeah. Interesting.
No, Florida could be appealing.
Yeah. So yeah, and I agree with you, by the way. I think Buffalo has fallen down the list of likely destinations. Dunedin, if they needed a stopgap, they're already based there. It's an easy, seamless transition if you need to do that. And if you're looking at a longer stay, then I do think some, you know, Pittsburgh is specifically the spot I think that would be atop their list. And the questions from the Pennsylvania government that prevented the Blue Jays from playing there before, I think would have been eased by this point in time, right? Because now we've seen, all right, like the Penguins are playing, the Steelers are playing, you know, it's not without precedent. Whereas baseball in the summer was forging this path for the first time in a lot of ways. So I do agree that that's, you know, probably not the biggest factor for free agents, but it's something that will be on their radar in those conversations.
Yeah. And there's questions of where can you have fans, right? Like how would revenue split work if you were playing, you know, sharing with Pittsburgh or sharing with Baltimore, you know, in Dunedin, like what kind of crowds could you attract down there? When can we have fans at Rogers Center in Toronto? When is the vaccine prevalent? Are we playing baseball at all until vaccines are widespread? Really? Like what are they starting this season? At any point before a certain percentage of the population, or at least a certain percentage of athletes, have the vaccine?
Well, and it's funny, you know, when you think about, okay, this is a big, big question for Blue Jays fans and for the Blue Jays and for any free agents that they're targeting, but it's also not unique within the landscape of pro sports, where in the course of the last 9-10 months, we've all just gotten used to all kinds of structural uncertainty about just about everything. And that applies to players more so than us from the outside. They're living it. They're used to this uncertainty. So it exists, but it's not different than what they'd encounter with any team. It's different, but it's not as though signing with the Cincinnati Reds doesn't have uncertainty as well.
Right. No, for sure. I think the next big like discussion in baseball will be the players saying, hey, tell us when to report to camp. We're ready to go. Let's play 162. Pay us, baby. And then the owners trying to say, hey, we could interpret this language in the CPA to say, actually, we need to delay the season because of, you know, force majeure or whatever, you know, because
that's right.
Of, you know, an international pandemic. That's going to be the next kind of big debate. And the big kind of thing that's really tough to slog through here is these two sides bicker with one another. So stay tuned for that. Couple questions here about the Reds. So let's go with this one. Based on recent rumors, the Reds are possibly looking to shop Luis Castillo along with Sonny Gray. Would the Jays be able to offer something concrete for both these starters?
Yes, and they should. Those starters are great. Luis Castillo is awesome. He would be a great pickup. So would Sonny Gray. The Reds apparently need to cut back on their payroll. They are, you know, 1 year after signing Mike Moustakas, and of course Bauer was on that team. Gray,
Castellanos,
another big addition for them. They really seem to have to dial it back, and you know it's one of those markets that's maybe not quite as well equipped to weather financial uncertainty and certainly one of the smaller markets in the game. So this creates an opportunity for bigger market teams like the Toronto Blue Jays, who do have more economic certainty, who do have more just money to spend, candidly. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Gray would be a tremendous addition. So would Castillo. I think those are conversations that the Blue Jays should have. And knowing their thoroughness when it comes to checking in on acquisitions or potential acquisitions, I'd be very surprised if that conversation hasn't begun to some extent.
Yeah, it's. I have nothing to add to that. Other, you know, obviously the Blue Jays should be players there. It's just kind of depressing to see Cincinnati operating this way when, you know, they have a really solid core and really good players. I thought they were going to be they definitely were a playoff team this year, but they weren't like quite as good as people thought they would be. They were kind of like my sleeper pick for 2020, and you know, they've got a great like core that they could add to and good young players. Like they could be good going forward, but unfortunately they don't want to spend money.
Yeah, tough times. Tough times for the Reds. All right, we got one more here before we take a quick break. And this question returns us to the prospects in the Blue Jays system. And it comes from Selwyn. If the Jays don't add further starting pitching depth, could you see Simeon Woods Richardson climbing further through the ranks and getting a shot before the end of the season?
So like a shot in the majors? It's like
that seems to be the implication, yeah.
He'll be up against it. I could see it for sure. Like he's super young. Like I'm not sure if he's turned 20 yet. He might just have turned 20. So he's like, you know, pretty raw and still developing, certainly. But I think that he probably starts the year at like double A, which is like pretty aggressive for a player of his age. And sure, if he kind of like blows the doors off and there's an opportunity in Toronto towards the end of 2021, I think that he could be a candidate for that. Certainly, I think the more realistic guy who gets to the majors really quickly would be Alek Manoah. And I think that's a guy who absolutely could pitch on this team in 2021, coming out of the bullpen, throwing gas, like 100 mile an hour fastballs with like nasty wipeout sliders from the back end of that bullpen. Like Alek Manoah has like all the makings of this team's future closer in 22, 23, 24. They're trying to get him to develop that changeup and to kind of round out the starter's repertoire. And like, great. Like if that guy can log a bunch of innings for you as a starter out of the rotation, that's even better. But like this guy has the tools, the physicality, like the ability, the kind of mental makeup, I think, to be a future closer for this team, like to be a closer for this team right now, probably. Obviously, they'll continue developing him, but that's the guy I'd have my eye on for 2021.
Yeah, to start with the Woods Richardson question, I do not expect him in the majors next year. I think 22 is a reasonable timeline for Woods Richardson. Just on Manoah, interesting. You know, I agree. He could impact the major leagues this coming season, and that'd be a lot of fun to see. Wrote about him recently at sportsnet.ca, so people can check that out if they're interested. But closer, I would think they try to keep him as a star. I mean, I think he could close right now.
Don't you think he could be this team's closer today? I honestly think that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Today.
So. Like, yeah, for sure.
If they have
for
a game tomorrow, I think they could give him the ball and he could get big league hitters out with the fastball slider because they're both that good.
And he might have to push Jordan Romano out of the way first, but you know, he could be in that mix. And yeah, I think he has a shot of making the majors as soon as this coming summer.
But yeah, obviously best case, he develops a changeup and it's effective and he's like turning a lineup over a couple times and pitching as a starter for you. Absolutely best case. But I think, you know, that's a guy who I'd put in a major league bullpen right now. He's legit.
He is.
Let's take a break, but we will continue with more of your questions after this on At The Letters. It continues on At The Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith, our producers Mike Tassoni and Christian Ryan, and we are taking your questions. Ben, this one comes from Kyle Derbyshire, whatever. I'm going to get some names wrong. I'm just going to have to deal with it. Could you guys see the Jays signing a big name free agent and still trading for Francisco Lindor?
I could. This might be one of our quicker answers here. But yeah, I could. I think that in the scenario that Lindor signs with the Blue Jays, and let's say, you know, LeMahieu goes to the Yankees, the Yankees are suddenly out on Lindor. Maybe, you know, maybe the Mets obviously don't land him either. The Jays get Lindor. Maybe in that situation, they have a lot of money still to spend. And they could be in on those other guys. So I would not rule that possibility out. And I think that that's probably the A-plus offseason for the Blue Jays is Lindor plus the top free agent.
Yeah, the Blue Jays have opportunity, you know, around the diamond at different places to fit players in. They have prospect capital that they can use in trades. They have money to spend, right? Like, there's two currencies in this game. You know, there's like hard, like cold cash and players who are, you know, I hate saying it, like a form of currency themselves in this game. So yeah, the Blue Jays have a surplus of both, and there's no reason why they couldn't fit really, you know, a top of the market free agent and a really good trade acquisition in.
That's right. All right, let's move on to our next question here. This one comes from Kevin Negro. And the question is, what do you both expect from Teoscar Hernandez next year? We haven't heard much about him this offseason. Is he going to be the version before the injury or after?
I'm not so worried about the injury with him. You know, like Teoscar Hernandez's career has been one of such like high peaks and low valleys, right? And there's just been so much, you know, he's just fluctuated a lot in terms of his performance. So it's kind of hard to like buy into anything, right? Like it was a 60 game season, right? And he probably would have played in 50 of the games or maybe even fewer. So, you know, it's kind of hard to just take that, say, oh, that's what he is now. And that's what he would be over the length of a, you know, full 5 or 6 month campaign. Like, even consider the fact that the game this year was played without fans in the stands, without that added pressure and the added kind of like adrenaline and increased heart rate. You know, it's probably a bit easier to lay off with tough pitches when you're not doing it in front of like 50,000 people at Rogers Center. So like, I don't know, you know, like it's very difficult to project him going forward. I mean, certainly you look at the exit velocities and how hard he hits the ball and the quality of contact that he makes. You look at his speed, you know, and his athleticism, and you say, yeah, there's like a lot of reasons why this guy should be able to continue his production, but he's going to have to keep laying off of bad pitches, getting to pitches that he can hit. I know it sounds simple, but I think that's what it is.
Right. And pitchers are more and more aware of Teoscar Hernandez. He's been around the league more and he's had more success, which makes him more of a focal point, I'm sure, for other teams around the league as they try to game plan, think, what does he swing at? What does he lay off of? Do we sneak in, you know, a first pitch curveball for a strike against him, knowing that he is a really good fastball hitter? So a lot of back and forth there for the Blue Jays. But, you know, when I think about what's a likely expectation for Teoscar Hernandez, I actually think that the likely outcome for him in 2021 is for him to be an above average, and I mean like well above average major league hitter. I think after what we saw the end of 19 and then in 2020, I would say a 120 OPS plus is reasonable, and that's really good. You know, that puts you in the conversation of being an all-star type outfielder. We'll see what he is defensively. I mean, I don't think that he necessarily, you know, as long as he can make the routine plays, that's fine. The Blue Jays have talked about his potential to be more than that, and that exists. But I think you're really looking at him as an offense first player. And my confidence level in him as a legit offensive weapon is actually pretty high.
That gets back to what I was saying with Vlad. Like, people suddenly stopped talking about Teoscar's defense once he, you know, became a Silver Slugger winner. Right.
Right.
He started
putting
up
better too.
A 900 OPS. Like, it was less of an issue when you know, when he was kind of struggling to find his way at the big league level for a couple seasons prior. His defense was like talked about, you know, incessantly. Just hit, man. All of a sudden people forget about your defense when you just hit.
It helps. I do think that objectively his defense improved as well.
Yeah. And I think the Teoscar Hernandez even like is a cool story. I wrote about it a little bit recently as a guy who like came out of a Dominican Academy, signed for $20,000 with the Astros, and has made his way now to 10 years later, his first year of arbitration, like finally getting, you know, some reward for what he has done and for the last 10 years of like really hard work that he's put in to get to this point. It's a cool story. David Parmer asks, with Jordan Romano and Teoscar Hernandez being a couple of 2020 success stories for the Blue Jays player development team, can you please comment on a pitcher and hitter who, in your opinion, will also take significant steps forward in 2021?
Wow, good question. I'm going to go on the hitter front. I'll go with Jordan Groshans, someone we already talked about. I think there's a lot of potential there offensively, and that would be a true breakout, right? Someone who has not played above, I don't think, a ball to this point. And for him to be able to contribute in the majors, that would be huge. It's not a guarantee, but I'll say that's a good breakout pick. And pitching wise, I can't take Nate Pearson, right? Like, that's too...
I mean, it's pretty good. Like,
yeah. But I mean, he wasn't, like, he didn't perform well in 2020. No. Like, he wasn't an effective pitcher by the measures that we would normally use. But maybe that's too obvious. So I'll tell myself that I can't pick Nate Pearson. I don't know. Let me think about that. Who do you have?
Ben, this is like when we have to make AL MVP predictions at the beginning of every year, and you just pick Mike Trout every time.
Every time. Yeah. Like, he'll probably be my pick again this year. It's like, he's the best player.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that is a bit too obvious. And I didn't come to all these questions with pre-prepared answers. So I'm honestly kind of thinking on the fly here.
I'll give you a chance to think here, because I'll say on the position player side, Otto Lopez, who's just added to the 40-man, is a guy that, you know, could have some breakout potential this year. Like, he's probably never going to, you know, lead the league in hitting or anything, but he's just like a good, solid, all-around player and still pretty young too. At just, I think it's like just like 22. So he's still got some growing to do. And Gabby Moreno is another guy that I think you should have your eye on as a, you know, I know Kirk gets a lot of headlines and a lot of love, and it's absolutely justified, but Gabby Moreno is like legit. Like, he tore up the alt site, like the MVP there. And he is currently doing some very nasty things to some Venezuelan pitchers in winter ball. So that's a guy to keep your eye on. And just a really interesting like athlete. He came up as a shortstop and was converted to catcher, which is like a pretty interesting progression, and it speaks to his athleticism and speaks to, you know, just the ability that he has and the speed and the hands and the feet. And he's got a really cool swing too. Like, I say this a lot, but like, he swings like a blue jay. Like, it's just really explosive swing. So keep an eye on him. And on the pitching side, I felt like this, like 2020 was going to be Patrick Murphy's breakout year. And it wasn't really, he got up at the end of the season and pitched well, but, you know, just in the totality, it wasn't really the, you know, the big year that I think a lot of us have been expecting from him. I think Patrick Murphy could be 2021's Jordan Romano or Julian Merriweather, where he like shows up at the majors, is throwing gas and getting a bunch of dudes out and looking really, you know, solid and composed and polished on the mound. So I'll take Patrick Murphy.
It's a good choice. Okay. So I've thought about this a little bit. I'll go with Elvis Luciano. It's a bit out there, but you know what? He's on the 40-man. He has already been in the major leagues, and you never
only
know.
Only two option years remaining, right?
Right.
Because he would have been optioned this past year.
Yes.
Would have been optioned in 2020. He wasn't optioned in 19. So
no, by definition, he could.
You got to find out on him within the next 2 years.
Yeah. So I'm going with Luciano. Let's see what he's got. That's my pick.
Cool.
All right. That brings us to our next question. And our next question comes from Dave Swenson. Who will be the Blue Jays' best overall player this year? Barring a defensive upgrade via signing or trade, will they get any better at run prevention? And so this is a little bit two questions in one. When I initially read this question, I'm not sure if this was Dave's intention, but when I initially read this question, I kind of read it as, who will the Blue Jays' best defensive player be in 2021? Which I think is a very interesting question, and one that got me kind of puzzling over that one. But I'll let you take that one however you want.
Yeah, I think best overall would have to include offensive production as well, right? Like, just
oh, no doubt. Yeah.
So the Blue Jays' best overall player this year, like, it'd be hard to not say Bo Bichette.
I agree.
Considering what we've seen from him already at the big league level, I'll give a sleeper dark horse candidacy to Lourdes Gurriel Jr., who, if he continues to kind of take the strides that we've seen from him, and if he like stays healthy and is, you know, really settled in a corner outfield spot, like, maybe all of a sudden, like, he's having a Teoscar year like Teoscar had last year, and it's like, hey, MVP votes and giving you solid defense, and you know, like, we've seen it from Lourdes before, like, he can, you know, the ball just like explodes off this guy's bat, you know, like, he makes incredible contact. So that would be a sleeper dark horse for me. And then, will they get better defensively without outside additions? I mean, there's still some, you know, growth potential, I think, for obviously Bichette and Guerrero and, you know, Kevin Biggio at certain spots, right? Like, he didn't look the most comfortable at third last year. So if he is playing some third going forward, like, maybe he can get a bit better. Like, I think Danny Jansen can get better. You know, Grichuk, Hernandez probably are what they are defensively. Goriel's a bit of a wild card defensively. So sure, like, I think there is some room for internal defensive improvement, But if you were talking about like a big improvement that's going to take this team out from being like one of the worst defensive teams in baseball last year towards like being in the upper half of the league, I think you're going to need some outside reinforcement.
I think that's true. And I agree with the initial thought there that Bo Bichette is the Blue Jays' best player. You know, obviously Vladdy belongs in that conversation, right? Until we get a better sense of how he fares, you know, watching his career year by year has been super interesting, has not lived up to that potential just yet, but we know it's there. So I think Bo is the answer. Vladdy's in that mix. And if we were to read this question as who is the Blue Jays' best defensive player, this got me thinking that I don't know that there's a clear answer. Like I don't
Jonathan
even,
Davis.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess he is. So you're going, you know, it's your fourth outfielder, right? It's a bench player.
Yeah.
Because even Santiago Espinal, like he's pretty good, but it's not even like their backup infielder is necessarily like this phenom with the glove. So this is not a team filled with defensive standouts at all.
Yeah. I might have said a couple of years ago, Marcus Stroman, like he's a sick defender.
I agree. He's an unbelievable defensive pitcher.
Like having another out infielder, you know,
yeah, absolutely.
He's on the mound. But yeah, Espinal is a good shout. I think like Espinal is really like, he's got good instincts, you know, and he just kind of like flows nicely when he's playing defense. You know, like I'll never forget the one play he made with, I think it was with Biggio during summer camp when they turned this just like absurd double play when they were both in the shift on the right side of the bag. It was like, the video's out there somewhere. I'm pretty sure I wrote about it. It was crazy. So yeah, Espinal's good shout, Davis. But yeah, the Blue Jays don't have like a standout defender, really. I think you're up, bud.
I think you are.
Oh, am I? Okay. Dan. Dan PB at DLindsay80PB asks, if the Jays don't sign a big free agent, think we might see a deal where the Jays take on some high-priced players like the Marlins deal from years ago? If so, whom?
Really interesting. And we've touched on some of these possibilities already in the course of this chat, right? So you've got, you know, the Reds, you know, it's not like Sonny Gray is a particularly high-priced player. I think he makes $10.7 million. But that's the kind of option that exists for this Blue Jays team. Lindor is a high-priced player. I mean, he's someone who's going to make 20-plus in ARB and then a lot more after that.
But that's like a bargain for Lindor, really, when you think about it.
Oh, no doubt.
Like $20 million for Lindor is like a, you know, there's surplus value you're going to get there.
Big time. And I think that's where the Blue Jays will be focused, right? I mean, it's very clear they can take on a contract. They can take on salary. They are not going to do that unless they believe that that player is worth the money. Or otherwise, you know, if there's a player who's making more than he projects to generate in value, they would expect that contract to be paid down. I mean, that's just a reasonable way to operate as a major league team. You're not, just because you have money, you're not just going to spend it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Blue Jays will, you know, I don't know if you're going to see them take on like a Votto contract, right?
No, I do not. Ridiculous. Think so.
But yeah, when it's like shorter term type of deals like Gray and Lindor, like they have room in the budget right now. And they should use that room, you know, even in free agency, the Blue Jays should be looking to like front load any kind of deals that they're signing with guys, because, you know, eventually like Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette, Kevin Biggio are going to hit arbitration. You have to pay these guys more. Teoscar Hernandez is already in arbitration. You got some cost certainty with Gurriel, cost certainty with Grichuk. You know, eventually your catchers are going to hit arb, right? It's the young pitchers like Nate Pearson, clock started. So eventually guys are going to start, you know, getting a little bit more expensive. And salary is going to start escalating a little bit. So you might as well like be using this room that you have now up front to front load contracts. You know, I think you can get creative that way. It's like, it's interesting that the, you know, listening to Mark Shapiro talk about it last week or 2 weeks ago, whenever that was, listening to him kind of talk about how the Blue Jays have separated out payroll from revenue. You know, like I think a lot of clubs right now, and a lot of front offices have a lot of budget uncertainty going forward because their owners don't know if they're going to have fans in the stands or not. They don't know if they're going to have paying customers. They don't know if they're going to be selling tickets and selling hot dogs and things like that. But like, you know, without that revenue certainty, you know, it's very hard to set your payroll budget. It's probably a big reason why the market's moving so slowly. But the Blue Jays, you know, it kind of seems different. You know, it seems like they've separated out. Like, look, our pay, we know. We didn't do well in 2020 revenue wise, not going to do well in 2021 revenue wise, but we're still going to pay on payroll. And so as Blue Jays front office, like having that guarantee and having that money now is like, all right, go use it. So maybe trade is one way that they find to kind of leverage that.
Right. And a good rule of thumb, if you're looking at a trade candidate, is to say, all right, if this player were on the free agent market, what kind of contract would he get in theory? And so for Joey Votto, if he was a free agent right now, he's probably signing a one-year deal. And it's, I don't know, is he signing for $10 million? Like, I'm just throwing a number out there. I haven't given it a lot of thought, but it's not what he's earning. So that tells you right there that if he were to be traded, just in a hypothetical, then the Reds would have to pay down that contract. So just, you know, for, if you're looking on Baseball Reference, and this is probably very obvious to a lot of people listening, but maybe it's not to some, then just think, what would this player make as a free agent? Use that as your baseline. And if they're making way more, then you're going to have to make an adjustment as you're going through those hypothetical trades. Got another question here. This one comes from Aaron Schultz. Realistically, who are the untouchable prospects or young players for a Francisco Lindor type trade? What do you think?
Just for Lindor, or like, I mean, I think that like
generally Lindor, because it's hard to do it in the abstract.
Yeah, if it's just for Lindor, like obviously, like you're not trading Austin Martin for Lindor, you're not trading Nate Pearson for Lindor, like I don't
Vlad,
know, like, yeah, Bo. Vlad, right? Like, and even then, like for Lindor, like is it, am I getting him for 1 year? Is he going to be signing an extension with me? I think that just like generally speaking, there are no untouchables in baseball. Like there's nobody that's, you know, anybody can be traded, honestly. I think it would be very, very difficult to find a scenario where the Blue Jays trade Austin Martin because they love everything about him and because like they've been blown away with everything he's done to this point. He went to the alt site, really impressed them, and like guys just rave about Austin Martin. So, you know, Nate Pearson, it would be very, very hard to imagine a scenario where the Blue Jays are trading Nate Pearson.
They're not trading, right? Nate Pearson.
So like I think that, you know, you can kind of look at players in that tier and like call them untouchables if you want, but like the word like untouchables, like it's just like a holdover from like a way that people talked about this game in the past. No MLB front office says untouchable. No MLB right. front office says going all in or any of these kind of terms. Like this stuff is, you know, it's kind of outdated.
Yeah. But I think in practical terms, like they're not trading Bichette. They're not trading Vlad. Yeah. They're not trading Pearson. I mean, Biggio, Lourdes, like maybe. Jansen, any of the catchers, I think, could conceivably be on the table. A pitcher's not named Pearson, I think, could be. I don't think they're trading Ryu. Like, I'd be really, really stunned if they traded Ryu.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean he's untouchable. You know, that's just, yeah. He's more, and obviously Cleveland wouldn't want Ryu anyway because he makes too much for them. But just in a theoretical, hypothetical kind of way, like, I think, yeah. It's
hard to build a scenario and to build a trade where the Blue Jays trade a Pearson or trade a Ryu and get better, right? Because in every trade, the Blue Jays just trying to get better. So like they'll say, yeah, well, like, I don't know, if we can trade a Ryu and like make our team better in 2021 and 2022 and give us a better chance of winning, okay, we'll consider that. I don't think that trade exists. I don't think it's possible to draw up that trade.
And to go back to the idea of what would this player make if they were a free agent, I mean, I think the Jays would gladly sign Ryu for 60 over three right now, which is what remains. So they should be happy to have him for that price.
Totally. Where are we at here? Jason Gortson. If the Jays landed Lindor, would you... this is hilarious, coming off of the discussion we just had. If the Jays landed Lindor, would you trade Bichette for Arenado straight up, with the Rockies taking on 50% of the contract?
Well, I would not do that. Yeah, I think that you just need Bichette. He's just too important to this franchise. I like the idea of, you know, thinking big with Arenado. I like the idea of, hey, the Rockies would have to pay some of that freight. There's an opt-out in there. It's a very complicated contract and one that's not very friendly to the team. It's really hard to get a read on what the Rockies are doing. I think that's a franchise that seems lost, directionless, and in trouble. And yeah, so trade with them, do what you can, get what you can, but don't give up Bichette to do it.
Yeah, I don't know what the Rockies are doing right now, honestly. And yeah, so this specific proposal, yeah, if I'm Colorado, it's a very easy yes. That like, yeah, I'll take Bichette.
Son of Dante Bichette, that'd be amazing for them.
Just, yeah, even just remove all of that stuff. Just Bichette for Arenado is an obvious yes. And even if the Rockies are paying half the freight, like obvious yes, the Blue Jays would never do that. But like, do you think that more generally speaking, like Arenado is someone the Blue Jays should be pursuing and that the Blue Jays should be thinking about taking on Arenado, you know, depending on how much of that contract Colorado is going to pay down, what the acquisition cost would be. How would you feel about that? You know, it's an interesting deal with the opt-out after next season. And I don't know, is it likely that he takes it if he has a good year? Is it really unlikely that he takes it because of the uncertainty with the CBA coming up after that? And just, you know, take the money that you have coming your way. How do you feel about that?
I feel very uneasy about acquiring a player with a player opt-out. By all accounts, that was one that he did not even ask for. The Rockies just gave it to him. It's an interesting approach.
Yeah, usually you have to negotiate for those.
Yeah, normally that's like a huge get. Yeah. It's an incredible advantage for the player who has the opt-out there. So, I think if you acquire Arenado and he has a really good year, then maybe you only get him for 1 year. If you acquire Arenado and he doesn't have a good year, then all of a sudden you have this player who's making, I think he has very close to $200 million remaining on his contract and guaranteed money. That's a lot of money. That would be
35 per through his age 35 season.
So, you know, that's like Ryu plus Russell Martin plus, like, that's a big, big commitment, you know? And he's a really good player, but you also have Austin Martin. You also have Jordan Groshans. You have Vlad trying to get himself back into that mix. Now, don't get me wrong. As we were saying before, if you could get Arenado, like, you want Nolan Arenado. I just don't think that this is the time or way to make that happen.
Yeah, I just don't think it's a fit, really. But, you know, obviously, like, if you can get Arenado, that's what makes it difficult to talk about, right? Because it's like, yeah, of course you want Nolan Arenado. He's a tremendous player. But then you have to, like, kind of think about it from the team's perspective and, you know, payroll-wise and projecting forward and with the opt-out uncertainty and acquisition costs and all these things. Like, it's kind of hard to see it lining up.
You just take on a lot of risk. And the reward is there, too, but you take on a lot of risk.
This front office hates risk.
Yeah, they've avoided a lot of it so far. It seems like they're diving into the deep end of some pretty, you know, significant and therefore risky free agent deals. And, you know, that things could get pretty interesting. All right, so that's it, I think, for our questions. Oh, no, we have one more.
Yeah, there's my favorite question. One more. I saved it for the end because it's the one favorite. I actually want to talk about.
All right, so this one comes from Danny Midawesome. And again, apologies if I've said anyone's name wrong in the course of these questions. Arden, what is the best and worst holiday food?
Great question. First what do you of all,
got? Tremendous it is a question. Great question. It's a really good question.
And like constructed concisely, you know, just straight to the point. Perfect. For me, like honestly, I'm going stuffing as my favorite holiday food. Turkey's great. You know, lots of things are great about holiday. There's not a lot of holiday food I don't like, but it's tough to beat like a really good stuffing. If you're, you know, using some really good bread, like using like cornbread, you know, or if you're like going nuts and using brioche, but you know, like a good cornbread stuffing, I think is really good with, you know, like do it right. You know, don't like skimp, like do like some serious, like buttery mirepoix in there, right? Like if you threw some leeks in there, I don't think that's crazy. And then I want like a good sort of, some sort of a salty bacon throughout it, whether that's like a pancetta or, you know, just a, like a double smoked bacon or something, like just, but like, give me like good, like little cubes, like give me like a lardon sort of thing through there. Delicious little salty little morsels throughout your stuffing. And give me some nuts in there as well. And you can, you know, use whichever nuts you want, man. Like walnuts, you know, chestnuts underrated, like pecans. I just throw macadamia in there, man. Like just get nuts. Make that thing nice and crispy and delicious in the oven. That's my favorite.
Wow. This sounds like a real stuffing fan.
Big time. Yeah. I love stuffing. Yeah. Stuffing's great. Yeah, it's bread bathed in butter. Like, what's not to like?
It is great. So I am a vegetarian. So the pancetta aspect of that would be beyond my realm. But certain, like, you know, you're talking about the veggies and the bread and butter. And that's what's not to like about that.
Yeah,
I think, you know, holiday food, even more broadly, being a vegetarian is, it's always been just like a different experience because so often the centerpiece of these family meals is, you know, you have the ham or you have the turkey. So I would go, and some people might laugh at this and say like it's a side, which I guess they could say about stuffing too. But I love mashed potatoes, like a really creamy mashed potatoes, like really buttery, just really like soft potatoes, obviously mashed, salty,
Great. Well, but there's levels of mash with the potatoes, right? Like you can go like almost like whipped potatoes where it's like super like buttery and creamy.
I don't like it like watery, but I do like it smooth.
Right. So you don't like a rustic mash.
I don't want chunks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like a rustic mashed potato. Are you skin on or skin off?
Oh, either way. It doesn't matter.
Skin on for sure is the way you got to go. All the nutrients are in the skin, but also like it just gives you a nice little texture and a nice little bite.
And it looks good too.
Right. So I like a little like, you know, a more rustic consistency to my mashed potatoes, certainly. And hey, you want to like take a bulb of garlic and have it and throw a little bit of olive oil on it, put in a little tinfoil pouch, fire it in the oven for 45 minutes, roast it up and squeeze that in there. I'm not mad at that.
I'm not mad at that at all. A garlic mash is great. Yeah, that is a great call. I think actually now that we're like on
least
this.
Least favorite? Hang on. Least favorite.
Well.
Because that was part of the question.
Yeah, it was. I'm going to add on to my favorites here first. So favorite.
You want my least favorite? I'm going to give you another favorite.
Yeah. Like it would just be like any kind of appetizer, you know? Like I'm not super big. Like I do like chocolates, especially around Christmas. But I think the appetizers, you know, like if you have... yeah, like some cheesy little appetizers. That's like a great way to go.
Like a little vegetarian spring roll, perhaps?
Perhaps.
Or you want just like cheese on crackers?
No, more like baked. Like have you ever had cheese coins?
Yeah. A little baked like cheese puff type of deal.
Yeah, cheese puffs, cheese coins. Those things they're unreal. So that also goes in the category of my favorite holiday food. Now, least favorite, I don't know. I mean, I could say tofurkey because I've had it and it's, you know, it's
doesn't even sound good.
No, it's not my favorite, but it's not horrible. It's not like it gets a bad name, so I'm not going to go there. I don't know. Maybe I'll draw inspiration from your answer here, but nothing is like jumping to mind.
So to me, I'm just not a cranberry sauce guy.
Yeah.
And I don't really understand its purpose on the table and what it's doing. Like, what do you put it on?
And I always assumed it was for the meat. Because I never really used it.
So if you like, I don't want a bunch of like sweet, gloopy cranberry sauce on my meat because I've cooked my meat properly and it tastes delicious.
Yeah.
So because I've like brined that bird and I have treated it with the care that it deserves. So the meat is going to sing and taste delicious. So I don't really want any cranberry sauce on there. I want cranberry sauce on my mashed potatoes because then I'm losing the roasted garlic that we've already put in there. I don't want it on my veggies because I've tossed my veggies in some butter and salt and pepper and they're freaking delicious. Maybe I've like roasted my squash, right? Or, you know, I've like blanched my green beans. They're still nice and crispy. Like I want that flavor. I want to taste the broccoli. So to me, the cranberry sauce just like takes over anything you put it on. So I don't need it.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. I'll add to the least favorite column here would just be like a heavy dessert because it's just not needed, you know?
Yeah.
Because so often, you know, you're eating kind of all day. You don't need like a big heavy dessert opinion. No, but I do love a nice little chocolate, maybe an aperitif, you know?
That's yeah.
A good way to
something
go.
Small. Yeah. Give me like a nice stout for dessert. I'd rather have that. Honestly. Sure. Right.
Yeah.
Like, give me a delicious, like imperial stout.
There it is.
High alcohol percentage, like delicious and like nutty and like kind of even like oaky dry stout. That's what I want instead of like cake or something.
I like it.
It's probably the same caloric load, but like it's you're drinking it and it's delicious and you know the alcohol's helping you along and everything's great. So give me that instead of dessert.
I hope Danny got the answers he was looking for.
Yeah, you got the most thorough answer of anybody who asked a question. You had something on your mind there.
Well, as long as we're on the topic of ATL questions, we're on our last episode here of 2020. It's been a year where I think we went. There were like months where there was no baseball, no possibility of baseball, no like idea when it was going to happen. Obviously, we kept doing ATL. A lot of people kept listening. Most people kept listening, which is awesome. So thanks to everyone for sticking with us. And so I think I've had a few people bring this up and I think that they make a good point because we started some threads of conversation during that time that we have not fully picked up. And so this being the last episode of 2020, I think it is only appropriate that we follow up on, you know, my new sports fandom and your vegetable garden. Yeah, and give the listeners some long overdue clarity. I mean, we've been distracted by baseball for months, but yeah. So you, at some point, I don't even remember what episode or when this was, but at some point you were outlining your plans to start a vegetable garden.
Yeah.
What happened? How'd it go?
I got it off the ground. It went okay. It went like, it's my first year doing it, right? So it was more like lessons learned than anything, but like, it was pretty good. I had a bunch of stuff going, man. I got to upfront thank my mom, because she was like huge. She's a legit like horticulturalist. So she's been doing this for a very long time, and she's a pro. So like, when I couldn't actually get stuff outside at the very sort of beginning of spring, when it was still kind of chilly and still having some frost at night, she was able to keep some of it growing indoors, because she's got a whole setup. So she was huge. She was like my spirit guide throughout this whole thing. But awesome. It was a good first year, man. I had, you know, tomatoes all year. Tomato plants did great, which was awesome. I had a bunch of lettuces, which were good. Ultimately, the squirrels ended up getting to those. But I had a good amount of salads out of my lettuces there. What else? Green beans were delicious. Had those. Had some peppers that were kind of like hit and miss, but they did okay. Peppers were okay. I've got garlic in the ground right now.
Right.
You plant garlic in fall, and then you let it chill over the winter, and then it comes up in the spring. You get some scapes first, and then you get, after that, some full-on heads of garlic in the ground. So that's what's growing right now. I don't know if I'm forgetting anything. Oh, herbs. Herbs are easy, but basil, parsley, like just having fresh herbs from the garden all year was great. So it was good, man. It went pretty well. I learned some lessons. It'll be even better next year, I think.
Right. Because this was your first year really diving in.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like you got some good stuff. Like, it sounds like you got, like, you legitimately like harvested food that you ate.
Yeah. No, I legit ate a bunch of food from my garden this year, which is awesome. Really That's rewarding.
Really cool.
So it was cool. Tell me about F1 or the NFL.
Oh, man. So yeah, this year has marked a shift in my sports fandom, because, you know, obviously I'm a baseball first, at times like borderline baseball only sports fan. Not really, but really baseball first. And then this year, I think because there wasn't baseball, and also because I'm home more. So I'm not out hanging out with friends, or I'm not out traveling or just doing different things. Like it's much more, you know, it is a very different type of year. And so I watched so much NFL and so much F1, and it's been great. Like, the NFL is kind of fraught for a bunch of reasons. When you think about what kind of, you know, concussion issues exist in that sport, but it was a lot of fun to watch the NFL this year. And F1, as our producer Christian Ryan knows very well, it's just an incredibly entertaining product to watch. So watching both of those was great this year.
So I know the F1 documentary on Netflix got you into motorsports. What got you into NFL?
I think it was just the timing of it, right? Yeah. Where you have baseball kind of ends, and then it's like, all right, there's no hockey, there's no basketball. Not that I would normally watch a lot of hockey or basketball, because I just don't. But I think the fact that they weren't on really highlighted the fact that the NFL was front and center. This is the sport that you're going to watch. People, I feel like, are talking about it more this year. Maybe that's just my own bubble, or maybe it's just me seeking out people who are talking about it.
It's the only thing on, right? Like, there's no hockey right now. Basketball is just starting up. So the fact that like the NFL is really like the only show in town is probably why it's been talked about a bit more.
Yeah. And it's been like watching Patrick Mahomes, for example, it just feels like you're watching Mike Trout. Like, it just feels like he's that good. Like, he's on that level. He's so clearly better than the competition. He does different things that other players can't do. It's insanely impressive to watch these players who are really good. I'm not totally disconnected from other sports. And I think that because I never talk about them, I never tweet about them.
Yeah.
So people might think that I'm like more of a baseball recluse than I really am. Like, I've gone to hockey games and basketball games, and like I enjoy other sports. I have I know who Klay Thompson is, or I know who Matthew Stafford is. Like, I have opinions on some of these players even. But this year was more immersive. This year was more like I've probably watched like half the Chiefs games, you know.
Right.
Like, it's just by virtue of I have some of those guys on my fantasy team. So you end up developing way more familiarity than I normally would have, because in the past it would just be, you see the highlights and that's about it. And the same with F1, where it's like, this year I was, you know, Christian can attest to the text that I would send him, but like I was watching like probably most of the weekends when they would race. I would watch most of the races. It was great. Super compelling.
All right. Thanks to everybody who sent in a question. Thanks to everyone who listened to Add the Letters in 2020. Very much appreciate it. Thanks to our producers, Mike DeSoni and Christian Ryan, for being with us throughout 2020. If the Blue Jays do something spectacular, we will be back to talk about it. I feel like it's like a 4-win player threshold, you know?
Yeah.
If they sign or trade for a 4-win player or above, we'll come back and talk
about it. You will hear from us.
If they don't, and if they do something that's beneath that 4-win player threshold, you might not hear from us until 2021. But I promise you that whatever the Blue Jays do, we are going to be here to talk about it at some point. So for Ben, I'm Arden. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next time on At the Letters.